Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar.
From the filmmakers of the critically acclaimed blockbuster Unfit, The Psychology of Donald Trump, which grossed over $2.5 million and was viewed by millions of people. That particular production team is back with a brand new documentary called Untruth, The Psychology of Trumpism. And it continues to examine the psychology of Trumpism and the authoritarian strain that is seated in the American political landscape. Terrific film, really wonderfully done documentary film. We're joined today by the director, producer, and writer, Dan Partland. Dan, welcome back to Film School Radio.
Oh, it's so good to be back. Thank you so much for having me and for that nice introduction.
Yeah, and by the way, I also want to point out that you and Rob Reiter collaborated on God and Country. It came out, I believe, earlier this year, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, it came out theatrically across the country in February and then streaming everywhere starting a few months later.
Yeah, terrific stuff from all around. I really appreciate you've really taken on a chunk of not just as we're going to be discussing Donald Trump, but the environment in which we live now. There's so much here to be understood. Hopefully, as time progresses, we'll have an opportunity to kind of step back and say, what were we thinking? But for right now, we're in the middle of it. So I want to talk about after you did Unfit, at what point did you say, you know, I think there's more to be told. I think there's more to a story about not only Donald Trump, but Mizugash around him that we are now dealing with.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think I, along with a lot of people in the sort of anti-Trump center, really believed that if Trump was defeated at the ballot box in November of 2020, that would be the end of him. You know, it's not common for defeated one-term American presidents to stick around and to continue to have such an influence on our politics. But obviously, January 6th happened, if anybody remembers that date. January 6th happened, and then there was a brief period of a couple of days where it seemed like maybe Trump was really vanquished, that the Republicans were leaving him en masse, that it was this January 6th was unmistakable betrayal of his role and responsibility to American principles, et cetera. And then, of course, we watched, began with Kevin McCarthy going down to Mar-a-Lago to see him, but we watched as he rebuilt his coalition, basically, as people began to normalize and accept his behavior and begin to rewrite the story of January 6th as being something actually patriotic. I think it was pretty clear as early as, you know, maybe 6 months into the Biden administration, that Trump was resurgent and that his power was not at all diminished and that he was continuing to be in control of the Republican Party and that he was likely the nominee. Now, when we decided to make the film, The Psychology of Trumpism, it was a realization that Donald Trump, the first film dealt with Trump and his own psychology and, you know, in the history of people with that kind of psychology and what that has done, you know, world leaders, malignant narcissists, and how poorly that's gone in previous historical eras. But it was pretty clear that Trump isn't even the issue anymore. Trump, there have always been guys like Trump. That's not a new phenomenon. The question is, why at this moment in history was the ground soft for this Trumpist, this angry, malevolent, divisive, intolerant, nativist, nationalistic, ethnocentric movement to put down roots? And it really has put down roots. And so the question is I think for the American public now, is not to write it off. I think there's been too much just writing off Trump as silliness. He'll be vanquished and that'll be the end of it. But to understand that, forget Trump. This is going to be with us for a long time. It's going to be an ongoing process. Nobody knows quite how long. I don't know if it's just years or still decades, but we have to get more insight into this phenomenon, into the reasons that led to Trump's rise, if we want to defeat it, because it's here with us. And just remember, 60, 70 million people voted for him. Again, right? Not after we knew the malevolence, after we knew the chaos, after we knew the pattern of criminality. They voted for him again. And I think it's pretty clear that similar numbers are going to vote for him in November. And so this is here. This is here. It's real. And we have to understand it.
I want to frame what you said, what happened in 2020, and obviously what happened on January 6th. The Republican Party had a perfect opportunity to wash their hands. He was impeached a second time. And after most of the leadership in the House and Senate had stood up and said, this is unacceptable. We cannot allow this kind of behavior. They did all the hand-wringing and chest thumping about it. It had every opportunity. He was gone. He had been defeated. They impeached him, and they could not get, I don't think they got one Republican senator. Maybe they did get one. I think Romney voted for impeachment in the second impeachment. If they had done that, he would have been ineligible to run again for president. He would have been gone. So it is all of the things that you said, but there is something that when there was literally no cost to the rank and file Republicans in the House and Senate, because he would have disappeared at that point, they still did it. And I do think that you've addressed it in this film very effectively. There is a anger in the country that the Republican Party, since Ronald Reagan invited the evangelical, the white evangelical movement into the tent and embraced them, that they have been playing with fire for the last 40 years. And this is what I believe. And again, I believe this is part, a big part of what has happened.
Yeah, I think that, look, I think there's a good case for that framing. I think that, you know, for those of us who have sort of lived through what it is basically, let's say, a 40-year rise in conservative politics in America from Ronald Reagan from 1980 to George W. Bush 2000, right? That's a 20-year rise there. And then it's continued. It's continued, you know, in a sense to this day with some, you know, some setbacks. But I think what you see in that period, you see the practiced use of conservatism as an intellectual cover for a lot of nativism. You know, and I think it always, to those of us who were skeptical, it always seemed like that. It always seemed like there was a lot of coded racial language, Christian nationalist dog whistling, white supremacist dog whistling that was going on. But it was given a intellectual cover under the guise of conservatism, the language of small government and, you know, and strong national defense and stuff. What's interesting is I think that that movement has been so enormously successful in accomplishing its goals that around about 2000, it started to lose steam. It lost steam not because it wasn't a popular ethos in the country. It certainly had taken over a lot of the right of center Americana, particularly, of course, rural voters, church-going voters, et cetera. I think they loved the Americana of it, the feeling of a cultural identity there. But in terms of policy, it had become so enormously successful in accomplishing its goals. I think at that point, really, it started to become a perversion of itself. It started to reach for things that were kind of beyond the definition of what the intellectual foundation of conservatism was about, and just started to look for tearing down government in all forms, started to corral things around this vaguely nativist idea that then came into full bloom in the Trump era, really because he normalized it. He made it okay. He was, you know, for whatever combination of traits Donald Trump has, one of them is that, you know, he's perceived as a, you know, rich and powerful, accomplished business person who knows how to get stuff done. Right. Now you could we can argue whether any of that is true, but that's how he's perceived. And I think for a lot of the country, that having a guy like that validate a lot of their feelings, some of which were about growing grievances, about ways in which they felt like they were not getting their due. It validated it. There, here's this guy, this billionaire who thinks like I do, and so now it became okay. But I mean, there's no question. There's all kinds of this happening all over the world, happening all over the world, and it's to the Democrats' perpetual embarrassment that they have not found a way to speak to this aggrieved portion of the country with appropriate respect. Right, to take their issues seriously. Now, some of their issues are, when that many people feel a certain way, it's real. You can't just dismiss it as untrue. And I think there's been a lot of like effort to dismiss things as untrue. These feelings are real. Understanding where they're coming from is a different thing. Now, a lot of them are fomented. They're trumped up, and giving people appropriate understanding of the problem would go a long way to, shaping a better response to it. But trying to ignore the border, trying to ignore the fact that it just feels wrong for so many Americans who are struggling at how many resources seem to be going to people who are not paying into the system. That's like a core justice principle. And we have to speak to that. We have to speak to that if we're going to ever kind of bring people back to a more positive politics, a more engaging politics that seeks to lift people up instead of just tear people down.
And I loathe to even begin to go down the many rabbit holes that we could go down in this discussion. Because no, not you, because I'm hearing what you're saying, and I will say something that I believe I even said to you when you were on for Unfit, and that is, those people are getting fucked. They've been getting fucked for a long time. The people who are mad, many of them are completely justified. It is the disgusting spectacle of the one person in American politics who could care less about anyone but himself that they chose to latch onto. That's a problem, right? And I blame the Democrats as well because, and I'm going to, this is a little bit in the weeds, but I think it's relevant. Going back to the end of the Reagan years, and I include the first and only term of George Bush in that, right? When Bill Clinton came along, one of the first things he did was to eviscerate the left wing of the Democratic Party. It was the DLC Democrats, right? And they were all corporate Democrats, and they tried like hell to pretend like the issues around poverty, around dismantling the Department of Defense and reallocating those resources, the Soviet Union collapse, all kinds of opportunities along the way. And they completely walked away from that. So this is a failure, not only a failure of commitment on the part of the Democrats, but also the chicanery and the misdirection of the Republican Party. So there's a plenty of blame to go around. Why Trump? And one last thing, it's a statistic that I still cannot get out of my head, and that is Donald Trump is probably the only one besides Dwight Eisenhower in the modern era that came into running for president with 100% name identification in the country. Everyone had an opinion about Trump when he ran. So there was a confluence of all of these different things, and he is a cipher. He is black swan, if you will. He is the one thing that the political system could not plan for. And that's what I to me, that's a lot of what's going on here. But it starts with these people who are genuinely upset for genuinely good reasons, and they latched onto him.
No,
Yeah.
absolutely, absolutely. And this the I think to sort of bring it back to more closer to where the content of the film is to is that I think let's take it away from Trump. Strong men in general, like authoritarian leaders, particularly that have this kind of right-wing ethno-nationalist slant. They're doing something that in some ways makes a lot of sense. They are speaking to, in a satisfying way, they're speaking to the emotional pain that people feel, right? Somebody goes in, they shoot up a nightclub, and Trump is out. This is during the 2016 campaign. He's out the next day proposing a Muslim ban. The shooter happened to be a Muslim. There's something that makes a lot of sense about that. People connect with that emotionally. Now, it doesn't hold up to scrutiny as policy, right? There's a tremendous number of domestic shootings, of mass domestic shootings, of domestic terror, overwhelmingly committed by native-born people. So, you know, trying to keep a handful of Muslims out of the country because this one particular incident involved a Muslim, it's not a sensible policy, and it's tapping into racial fears, right? That these people are a different race, they're not like us, and so they're more dangerous, even though there's abundant evidence that we're more dangerous to each other. At least he's speaking to the emotion of the moment. And so I think that, you know, that's the challenge right now, is how do we actually speak to the emotion of the moment, to logical, common sense responses that humans are having to crises, but offer meaningful solutions instead of knee-jerk solutions that aren't going to help anybody. I've looked at these other, you know, the Mussolini and Hitler, and looking at these other kind of times when this ethno-nationalism rose, and, you know, autocrats rose in different parts of the world. I think it's telling. I mean, there are a lot of things that unify these movements. For one, the leader does he foments division, yeah. Right? It's rising in strength by dividing people, and the division tends to be of a racial and ethnic nature. And there's a good psychological reason why that works. That works because that makes, you know, humans have an evolutionary bias towards feeling more positive feelings towards people the more similar they feel to them, right? That's exactly. That is just the way it is. So if you can cleave the culture along racial or ethnic lines, that's relatively easy to do. The other thing that unifies them is they tend to be completely incompetent at governance because they move so much just on their whim of the moment, and, you know, and incompetent in the policy arena as well. So when you're looking at this current stew that we're in, you do have Donald Trump offering people something that is emotionally valuable, while on the policy, on the actual role of government, not offering them much of anything. Now he's saying that he is, and some people are believing that things were better under Trump and whatever. But in a certain sense, again, this makes a lot of sense. The thing that people are hurting from in some ways the most is from feeling unheard. From feeling a lack of status, a lack of agency in the culture. Who are these people off in Washington and New York who are making all the decisions for us? They don't understand what my life is like, and they're not being responsive to my needs. You know, Trump is giving them, he is elevating their status. Their problems are being heard. The problem is he's not offering any meaningful solutions.
Just want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Dan Partland. He is the director of a terrific new documentary film called Untruth, The Psychology of Trumpism. And once again, at the risk of just completely hijacking this conversation, yes, I agree with everything you said. And there are a couple of things that struck me about the psychology of governing that the Republicans have been embarked upon. And I'll go back to the second term, maybe even the first term of George II, George Bush, George W. And that is they began, and it's a philosophy that sort of came out of Reagan era. And that is they continue to appoint people to positions as once they're president into cabinet level positions. They're avowed enemies of the departments that they're supposed to be in charge of, right? Department of Education, Department, State Department. There's all kinds of examples. Department of Agriculture, Interior, of people being appointed by Republicans who don't agree with the mission statement of those particular departments. And one of the geniuses of this kind of not wanting to govern philosophy that I think the Republicans have mastered, and that is once in power, they can ruin these different departments, which have a direct impact on people, right? health and education, all kinds of different departments. They put people in charge who've said, I don't agree with the mission statement. Then they can turn around and say to the American public, see, government doesn't work. And it dawned on me in 2020, and right around July, August, right around the time of the convention, that Trump had completely abandoned any facade pretext of actual programs that he wanted to implement as president. In the first term, he had to. He had people around him who were actually professionals who wanted to govern the federal government, at least. In August of 2020, it dawned on me, watching him, he has no proposals at all that he wants to talk about. And so it's sort of the culmination of all of that Republican philosophy about wanting to undermine the effectiveness of government in order to say government isn't effective.
There.
Yeah, no, I think there's a good argument to be made for that. You know, it is another feature of autocratic rule that eventually the government is nothing but a collection of the sort of interests and idiosyncrasies of the dear leader. That's it. You know, you see the Republican Party is this is a complex society, American society, Western society, complex, pluralistic society, billions and billions of dollars, millions of people, smart people, accomplished people of all kinds of expertise, putting their energy into government, putting their energy into industry, putting their energy into making our society work. And you watch, I mean, one of these important institutions, the Republican Party, is now just running in circles, chasing their tail, chasing whatever it is Donald Trump says from moment to moment, working harder and harder to come up with elaborate justifications to show how there is some rigor to any of these particular ideas, to turn offhanded remarks that he says into policy some way. I mean, it's not just tragic for what it's done to the Republican Party. It's tragic for what it's done to our politics, because we really need to have, I mean, I think we need to have more than two parties, but we at least need to have two strong, thoughtful political parties who are both working in the interest of through their own lens of what they see as in the American people's best interest. And right now, you know, sadly, I think we're just following the psychology, I hate to say it, but the psychology of a very unusual psychology of a man whose interests really don't lie in the betterment of society in general.
Well, look at the border deal. As a Democrat, as somewhat a liberal Democrat, most of that is kind of appalling to me. What the Democrats were willing to pass, a bill that was essentially a very conservative Republican senator put forward for the border policy. But I'm also realistic to know that just take this issue off the table and the Republicans will have nothing to do in with any other policy that matters. They can talk about cutting Medicare or Social Security, which is just might as well just all drink the poison Kool-Aid if you want to do that. But the fact that Trump just threw a temper tantrum and they took it off the table is all the evidence that you need. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm sure smaller versions of that happen all the time where politicians try to get in the way of a policy agenda that they believe in because they don't want to let any wins happen on their other side. I'm sure those versions of that happen, but it was an egregious example and it was on his signature issue, and it's on an issue that's a real issue. I mean, we have to solve. We have no coherence to our immigration policy. You know, this current situation in Ohio is actually an even more interesting example. The eating of pets aside, there is a real issue there, right? This very small town. This is a classic example of why we need coherent policy. Very small town, struggling post-industrially, has some new business prospects, building new business prospects, but doesn't actually have a population big enough to fill the jobs that these new industries are creating. At the same time, you have a humanitarian crisis in Haiti. We deliberately let the door swing wide for refugees from Haiti to come here out of our
humanitarian
compassion.
It's a great idea. Absolutely. Yeah.
And out of and not for nothing, out of the recognition that with such low unemployment in the United States, that we genuinely, without at least some kind of immigration happening, a trickle, I don't know what the right level is, we would not be able to fill the jobs, right, that
exactly.
that we're making. And it would ultimately be suffocating the economy. But of course, something like 20,000, 15,000 to 20,000 Haitians move to that little town. And of course, that's going to create all kinds of new issues for government, for the local population, not to even mention this, the way it's going to shift the culture there that could be very upsetting to people. So I think we have to understand that there is something very real in these immigration concerns.
Yes.
And how can we move the conversation into those real things and away from nonsense, racist nonsense about Haitians eating people's pets, because it really is a racial dog whistle that these people, you know, who are just like good and decent people who just had their homes, their communities destroyed in Haiti, looking to start over somewhere, that because they come from such a different culture, of a different skin color and whatever, that they are animals and that they're going to feed on our pets. It's just absurd. They're just hardworking.
It is one of the oldest racial tropes that you can find, is people who don't look like us are eating something, or they're savaging our young girls or women, or I mean, there's a couple to you can just pull out, and you know you're going to get a reaction. So you bring in a young white girl, or you bring in your dog being eaten by somebody. Yeah, I mean, it's almost too easy. It is, in fact, I really think that this might be the jump the shark moment for Trump.
It may be, but, you know, we've had those before. I mean, listen, I think the thing that we have to all reconcile with, and, you know, bringing it back to the movie a little bit, I mean, we're sitting here, you know, 50 days or so out from an election that absolutely, I think, is existential for the United States. And we've got a toss-up election, and we have it's a coin flip. It could really go either way. And that's despite the fact that one of the candidates is, you know, twice impeached, 34 times convicted of felony convictions, five, you know, different in 90 plus indictments, and really unquestionably led a violent revolt at the United States Capitol in an effort to overturn a free and fair election here in the United States, and came closer than anyone gives credit for accomplishing that goal.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. If Mike Pence gets in that limousine and leaves the Capitol, we would be having a very different discussion right now. Literally.
Absolutely. And I think just to go down that road one more step, I think the narrative that they had set in place prior was that Antifa was going to be out in force. And what the expectation was that the amount of unrest, the riot that they incited, was going to bring counter protest, and that as soon as there was counter protest, they would have the pretext for for some kind of martial law, suspending regular order and keeping Trump in office while this got sorted out. It would get thrown to the House. The House, settles an election that can't be settled by the Electoral College. And then we know it's one vote per state. And then that becomes how many states are basically tipping red. And it's no contest. So, and they, you know, and yeah. the claim would have been that that was constitutional, that they followed the Constitution. And, you know, and they would have shown that you could manipulate the facts on the ground to undermine a free and fair election using constitutional processes. That is what that would have approved. But in any event, we're sitting here and we have basically a coin toss to see what's going to happen to the most important stabilizing democracy on the globe. And that's a really, really scary thing. I hope, of course, that, you know, everybody does whatever they can in the next 50 days to try to make sure this election goes in the right way, because I think the fate of the world lies in the balance, genuinely. But, you know, whether it does or it doesn't, in the end, the good guys will prevail. The problem is how much damage is going to be done.
Yeah.
And I think what we have to accept is that, you know, we've all been screaming from the rooftops that he's an authoritarian. He doesn't care about law. What we haven't really accepted, and what the film tries to give a little more insight into, is that people do understand that he's an authoritarian. That's what they like about him.
Yeah.
They like it, yeah, because in the end, what everyone wants is they want results. They want, yeah, the result, and they want the results they want. Now, part of the pact that you make when you agree to live, you know, just the social contract of living in a democratic society, is that you're not always going to get what you want. And sometimes it is going to be very frustrating because you do have to accommodate the feelings of people who disagree with you. But we have a large contingent in the country that's frustrated enough that they don't really care about accommodating the feelings of people who disagree with them. They would like to elect an autocrat who will just get it done for them.
Well, if our conversation isn't triggering you out there listening to this, I want you to do what Dan just suggested, is to get out there and do something about it, because we do have that power. We do have a candidacy on the other side of the aisle that is energizing a lot of people in ways that I didn't expect. So there is some very, it isn't like there is nothing on the other side of Trump. There is a lot. And there are a lot of people who are more engaged in the democratic process, more engaged in civic activities because of him, than I think that we will be a better society on the other side. So I really, truly, I know we haven't spent nearly enough time praising this wonderful film, Untruth, The Psychology of Trumpism. It is really, really good, really solid. A lot of great information, a lot of great people. So many good people in the film. I sound like Trump when I say that. So many good people. But I'm a big fan of Malcolm Nance, and I think and there's so many others. I just want to single him out because I think he's amazing.
So, I'm very honored. We have the best talking heads. They're overwhelmingly conservatives, and clear-eyed conservatives. And we always say this film, just like Unfit, it is not partisan. It is distinctly anti-Trump, but not partisan. It's not even doesn't even have political ideology, except for a firm belief in democracy and the need for America to remain one.
Amen. Well, before we run out of time, this has been amazing. Thank you so very much for your time, Dan Partland. The film, again, is called Untruth, The Psychology of Trumpism. It is
on Apple and Google Play and YouTube and Microsoft and iTunes and Amazon Prime and Xfinity and Fios and Spectrum and Cox and Comcast and Shaw and Bell and Dish. It's everywhere but Netflix.
All right. Very good.
So thank you so very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It was fun. Oh. Really, really fun.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.